Well, hello everyone, and all the best of the season to you all. Today's teleclass is Clostridium difficile, the sinister spore saga, and it is the last teleclass lecture of 2010. It's also the ninth time that Dr. Michelle Alpha has given a teleclass lecture, and in fact, it is the ninth time that she has given the last teleclass of the year, and this is by no means an accident. Dr. Alpha is a principal investigator with the St. Boniface Research Center, and she is also a professor in the Department of Medical Microbiology at the University of Manitoba. She is a microbiologist by training with specific research interests in reprocessing medical devices and in Clostridium difficile. She is, in fact, a globally recognized expert on C. diff. Her research and her teachings have garnered her several awards for excellence, and she is an extremely popular instructor. She is also a very popular teleclass lecturer and one of my personal favorites. But before Dr. Alpha begins, let me also mention that this teleclass has been sponsored by 3M, and I'd like to thank them very much for the support of teleclass education. Now, to present Clostridium difficile, the sinister spore saga, it is a great honor for me to present Dr. Michelle Alpha. Michelle.
Well, thank you, Paul, very much for the introduction. Paul was reminding me that I guess I hold the record for longest number of years presenting in this format, and whenever he says that to me, it makes me laugh because it makes me feel really like the old dog I am, so bear with me. I'm really pleased to be here today to speak to you about Clostridium difficile, and I particularly like the picture that I found on Google Images, that nasty little three-eyed beast on the right side of the first slide, because it reminds me a lot of what C. difficile spores are like. And I have a number of objectives today, but prior to getting into that, I just want to make a statement of disclaimer that I have no financial affiliation to any of the companies. If there's products or components that are mentioned, I don't have any commercial affiliation with them. I am sponsored by many different companies to speak at different sessions, and the patent that I have for the artificial test soil that we developed is held through the University of Manitoba and has been licensed out to HealthMark. So just want to get all the disclaimers out of the way. The objective that I have is really to provide independent third-party data for a variety of different topics, and today's topic is Clostridium difficile. So if we go to the second slide, in overview, what I would like to do is just remind people about the organism and particularly about the diseases that are caused by it. We are seeing a change in our understanding of what some of the issues are, and I'm pleased and excited today to go over some of those with you, and in particular, the role of the spore in transmission, both in the healthcare setting, as well as a newly, I guess, discovered aspect of C. difficile pathogenesis, which is really the community exposure. More and more, we are starting to recognize that this is a lot more complex exposure cycle that this organism has than we previously recognized. And then finally, what I'd like to do is share with you some of the data from some of the studies we've done regarding spore issues in healthcare. So if we go to the next slide, Clostridium difficile is really quite interesting. If you look in the published literature, you will see that there is information regarding asymptomatic carriage. And in the studies that have been done, approximately 5% of the average population out in the community, if they were tested, they would be able to detect toxigenic C. difficile in those patients, in that population. And if they become hospitalized adults, up to 20% of hospitalized adults may asymptomatically carry toxigenic C. difficile. Now, what's interesting, and as I get into my talk, you're going to see that this is in some ways a strange phenomenon, because determining asymptomatic carriage is usually done by culturing stools from people that have no apparent illness. And of course, that is limited by the limit of detection of whatever assay method you're using. So even though we've listed 5% in asymptomatic general population in the community, if you use more sensitive methods, what has been found is that carriage rate does go up. And often what it's reflecting is the transient passing through, if you will, of the GI tract of maybe several spores, and the detection of those can be a little tricky. And we're going to touch on that a little bit later when we talk about the role of community acquisition and how does that happen and what does that mean. Now, I love the little picture on the right. Those are the lovely little neonates and babies. And as a grandmother who has a 3-year-old granddaughter and a 1-year-old granddaughter, I get very clucky about baby pictures, but this is quite a cute one. What's really interesting about neonates and babies of less than 1 year is that up to 50 to 70% of these neonates can actually carry toxigenic C. diff in their gastrointestinal tract, and they are totally asymptomatic. In fact, in the diagnostic laboratories, we will not accept stool samples on babies less than 1 year of age that are requesting C. difficile toxin testing because the asymptomatic carriage rate is just that high. It's a bit of an enigma why that occurs and how can babies carry these strains without any adverse effect is not really well understood. It's thought that maybe the organism stays in its spore form and therefore isn't actively producing toxins that will affect the babies, or alternatively that the receptors in the gut haven't developed to a point where the toxin of the organism are able to cause the disease as they do in adults. Whatever the explanation, it is interesting that neonates and babies seem to be essentially non-affected by toxigenic C. difficile. Now, if we go to the next slide, the disease that's caused by C. difficile is really quite interesting. The disease occurs primarily and almost exclusively in the large bowel. So you can see at the picture on the right where the stomach leads into the small intestine and ultimately feeds to the end of the GI tract in the large intestine. Now, people can carry toxigenic C. difficile as asymptomatic carriers, and I've already alluded to that. If you are unfortunate enough and you develop disease with C. diff, it will start off as mild diarrhea that becomes very severe quite quickly and can lead to colitis, which is essentially inflammation of the mucosal lining in the large bowel. And if it's left untreated and continues on, it can go on to develop PMC, which is pseudomembranous colitis, and or toxic megacolon. Now, both of these are really the severe end of the spectrum. In pseudomembranous colitis, I'm going to show you a picture in a minute, there are plaques that develop on the mucosal surface, and the barrier component of the bowel is deteriorated, and there's a great potential to actually have perforation. And toxic megacolon simply means your bowel has essentially stopped working. It's no longer got peristalsis. And if you think about it, it's a terrible analogy, but it's true. If the bowel stops with its peristalsis and you get toxic megacolon, it's essentially a closed-end organ that has organisms that are replicating in it, and it's like a pimple, and ultimately, obviously, would lead to bursting of the bowel. So toxic megacolon becomes a surgical emergency where the affected areas are resected or removed to ensure that that type of ultimate breakdown of the bowel integrity doesn't occur. Now, the other interesting thing about C. difficile disease is that recurrence occurs in approximately 25 to 30% of people who do get disease, whether it's diarrhea, colitis, PMC, 25% or a quarter of those patients will go on to have a recurrence despite being appropriately treated and despite initially clinically responding. The recurrence occurs when the antibiotics are removed, and then usually within 7 days, then the patient develops symptoms again and has another round of C. diff disease. Now, what's really interesting about this, Tom Louie was presenting some data at a C. diff symposium we had in Winnipeg about a week ago, and in the studies that they've done, the clinical trials, what they found is that if you get a recurrence, if you get more than one, and these people often do go on to have 2, 3, 4, 5 recurrences, if you end up having two recurrences of C. diff, it turns out that the efficacy of the traditional therapy to treat you becomes less effective, and you have a much higher risk of going on to have subsequent recurrences of the disease. So it's quite interesting in the sense that recurrence is a phenomenon that happens, and intractable rounds of recurrence often can happen in a subset of those patients who get this disease. So recurrence sounds like, oh yeah, well, they have mild diarrhea, but the reality is they have, every time when they get a recurrence, they have quite severe disease, and you run the risks of the outcomes being not so good. Now, if we go on to the next slide, this slide is C. difficile-associated disease, or CDAD, and as I mentioned, it is a disease in the low bowel, lower portion of the gastrointestinal tract in the large bowel. And the picture on the right, the arrow is pointing out the kind of yellowish plaques that develop on the mucosal surface of the large bowel in somebody who actually has C. difficile-associated disease. And you can see from that picture that a fairly large portion of the mucosal surface is affected by those plaques. And essentially, the disease itself is a multi-hit disease. The presence of toxigenic C. difficile must be there, and most often that is due to ingestion of the spore form of the microorganism. The second hit usually involves some imbalance to the normal GI flora. Most commonly, that can be done by antibiotics that are given that disrupt the normal organisms that are present in the microbiome in the bowel, and that allows for overgrowth of toxigenic C. difficile. Now, the component of C. diff that really is what damages humans is the production of toxins A and B. If there are strains of C. diff present, and there can be, that do not carry the genes for toxin production, they do not cause any cause for concern because obviously they don't result in damage to the bowel. It's only those strains that are toxin-producing C. difficile strains that cause problems. One of the areas that's a hot topic nowadays is assessing the host factors and what role do they play in whether people actually get the disease or they don't get it. And there seems to be some evidence, which is really quite controversial, that the humoral antibodies against toxins A and B, the presence of them may protect from getting severe disease. And one of the biggest enigmas is, why would antibodies in the bloodstream prevent disease from occurring when the disease really is occurring in the large bowel at the mucosal level, and there's not a lot of humoral or blood antibodies that would actually get through to the mucosal surfaces? There are some, and the thought process is that because the disease is making the gut mucosa leaky, there's more of those humoral antibodies that may actually get to the surface. Now, this is, of course, important because, obviously, if humoral antibodies do play a role, then vaccinating people and trying to prevent them from even getting C. diff would be one of the lines of research that, obviously, would be very beneficial. There, as I mentioned, there are a lot of projects going on to try and address that and see whether or not vaccine development might be a potential that that could occur. Now, the recurrence part of the disease that happens often is because that the GI flora has not reestablished. In other words, you have upset it or imbalanced it, and despite getting antimicrobial therapy that has eradicated the C. diff organisms, the normal flora, which usually keeps the C. diff under control, has not reestablished. And again, there is a lot of interest in understanding the role of humoral or mucosal immunity in terms of the potential risk of recurrence. And there are some studies that are being done now to try and address this issue. If we go on to the next slide, I like to preface this slide by saying this is a picture of the enemy. This is a Gram stain that we produced in the research lab, and it shows you the two different forms of C. difficile. The vegetative form is shown by the arrow at the very top of that picture. It's pointing to the large rod-shaped organisms. It's a Gram-positive rod that is an anaerobic microorganism. When you see the vegetative form, it means the organism is metabolically active and it's replicating. And of course, it can only do that when there is no oxygen present. And of course, the large bowel is a highly anaerobic environment, and so C. difficile is quite well suited to replicating in that environment. When the vegetative form is replicating, it's producing toxins A and B, and there's certainly evidence that there may be some other toxins that are also produced, but the current thought is that it's toxins A and B together that act synergistically and are responsible for the disease causing ability of this microorganism. Now, the vegetative form, because it's metabolically active, it can be killed by antibiotics. And the two primary ones that are used almost exclusively to treat C. difficile-associated disease are metronidazole and vancomycin. And certainly the replicative form is killed by those antibiotics. Now, on the other hand, there are a wide range of antibiotics to which C. difficile is quite resistant in constitutively. So antibiotics like the fluoroquinolone, ciprofloxacin as an example, when patients go in to have maybe abdominal surgery for totally unrelated reasons, and they may be prophylactically put on antibiotics like ciprofloxacin, you know, obviously that is going to damage or eradicate a large portion of the other bowel flora, but for the most part, it does very little to affect C. difficile because it's quite resistant to that type of antimicrobic. And so there are issues around antibiotic stewardship to try to reduce the risk that you will treat patients with a broad-spectrum antibiotic that will set the scene for them subsequently to develop C. diff disease. Now, the other thing about the vegetative form is that oxygen exposure does kill the vegetative form. And what would happen, my favorite analogy is if there was a gob of poop on the counter from a patient who had C. diff disease, the vegetative forms inside that gob of poop would be frantically trying to convert into the spore form so that they would be protected from the exposure to oxygen, because ultimately oxygen will kill those vegetative forms. Now, like all things in life, it doesn't happen instantaneously. It does take a number of hours of exposure before they are killed. And, of course, the question is how rapidly do the vegetative forms convert into the spore form? And we don't know exactly how long it takes, but it would take a number of hours because they have to synthesize proteins and basically rearrange themselves into the spore form. And the spore form, on the bottom part of that picture, you can see two arrows. The one arrow is pointing to a small, round, whitish structure, and you'll see that the spore form of C. diff is actually smaller in size than the actual vegetative organism itself. And you can see that the second arrow from that box is pointing to what looks like quite a rod-shaped organism. It's not staining darkly with the gram stain. And you can see the unstained end of it, which is where the spore is beginning to form. Now, that long rod-shaped form will eventually curl up and become a total spore form, and it will look like the little circular structure that you see in the other arrow. Now, the reason they don't look well stained is because the gram stain reagents cannot penetrate the spore coat, and therefore all they stain is some of the periphery edges of the spore, and that's why they look like white circles that have a little blue ring around them. The spore form is absolutely fascinating. It is not metabolically active. That's the whole purpose of the spore form. It's its survival mode, if you will. It does not produce toxin. So by definition, C. diff disease in humans is certainly not caused by the spore form. It's caused only by the metabolically active vegetative form. The spore form, because it's not metabolically active, is not affected by any antibiotic. Metronidazole and vancomycin, although they kill the vegetative form quite readily, they do nothing to the spore form. And so you can see that when I talk about a recurrence, you can see how that would happen, that the metronidazole may be killing off the vegetative form and the patient starts improving clinically. When they remove the antibiotics, of course, any spores that may be resident still in the gut will then be able to germinate and return back to the vegetative form and can then again produce toxin and cause disease again. Now, the other thing is that oxygen exposure doesn't kill the spore form, and obviously that's the mechanism by which it survives and facilitates transmission from one person to another. So you can see that in terms of the organism, it has a very interesting life cycle, if you could call it that, where in an anaerobic environment, it will want to go into the vegetative form as long as there's enough nutrients there, and it will replicate happily, producing toxin. And if that environment happens to be the large bowel, then of course the resultant toxins cause damage to the human body. When it gets expelled out in fecal material, obviously it will rapidly try to be in its spore form so that it can survive in the environment and survive to another day to try and infect another host. And I've got a reminder on the bottom of this slide that not all C. difficile strains carry the genes for toxin production. All C. difficile strains would have the capacity to be in their vegetative form or the spore form. And if we go on to the next slide, what I've got here on the left side is an electron micrograph, a transmission electron micrograph that is cutting through the spore. And what you can see is the very, very thick spore wall, if you will. And that's the reason that the spore form is so impervious to many types of agents. And we're going to talk or touch on that a little bit later. Now, one of the things that was quite controversial, or people mistakenly might think, is that in people who are ill with the disease, they must have only the vegetative form because the toxins are being produced and that's why they're sick. And one of the questions is, in those patients, do they really actually have spores in their stool? And what we did was we got patient stools. Within 3 hours of the patient having defecated, the diagnostic testing was done and they were confirmed to have C. diff toxin disease. And what we then did is we immediately set up and quantitated the number of spore forms in each gram of feces. And that was done by shocking them with alcohol, because alcohol treatment will kill the vegetative form, but it will not kill the spore form. And therefore, once we expose it to alcohol, we can then quantitate how many spores remain viable if we then put them onto nutritious media and allow them to grow out. And this data was published in 2010, and you can see that every one of the 10 patient samples that we assessed definitely had lots of spore form in them, despite the fact these patients were at that time having rampant C. diff disease and they were not on treatment at that time. So you can see that the range of spores goes from 4.4 spores per gram of feces all the way up to 8 logs of spore per gram of feces. So there's no doubt that when a small amount of fecal material is in a bedpan or on the surface, there can be very, very high numbers of spores present in that material. And if we go on to the next slide, I think one of the most interesting aspects of this organism is that we are now starting to recognize that onset and disease doesn't always happen in the hospital environment. In fact, in Manitoba, where C. diff has been reportable since 2006, we actually did a one-year study where we obtained stools from all the stools that were submitted across Manitoba in that year, and we did culture them for the organism and linked that to some of the clinical characteristics of where their onset was. And what we found in Manitoba, and this has been also confirmed and found in many other countries as well, is that about 70% of the cases have acquisition and onset within the hospital itself. So in other words, the patients came in, they didn't have C. diff, but they actually acquired it and the onset of disease occurred in the hospital. But fully a third or 30% of the cases, the acquisition and onset was actually in the community. And when you think about it, that's not surprising, because certainly there's a lot of antimicrobics given to patients that are not hospitalized. People who have any type of infection that may require antibiotic therapy, they may have the two hits necessary for the C. diff disease to occur. Now, what is really quite interesting to me is the extent of this disease, and I'm sharing with you Manitoba data, but I know that in British Columbia it's reportable as well, and when you look on the website there, you'll be able to see the very, very large number of patients that are affected every year by this organism. So in Manitoba, in 2009, there were actually 700 people in this province in that year that developed C. diff-associated disease. And when you put that in context and you look at the information I've provided on the left-hand side of this slide, if we take all other enteric pathogens, and by this I mean Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter, E. coli 157, if you combine all of those numbers, in the province of Manitoba in 2009, there were 497 patients in that year that were ill with all other bacterial enteric pathogens combined. So you can see the magnitude that C. diff has, and certainly the impact is really significant because these are all patients, or many of these patients end up having prolonged hospital stays because of having this. And this data is available through the CADM Provincial Laboratory, or CPL, website on reportable organisms in the province of Manitoba. Now, many other provinces in Canada have actually switched, and I think eventually we're going to see that every province will have C. difficile as a reportable organism, because it is important to not let this slide under the radar. Our rates in Manitoba haven't changed over the years, and certainly this is an unacceptable, in my opinion anyway, an unacceptable number of people that get affected every year by a disease that we think should have prevention methods that should reduce those rates. Now, the pie chart that's shown on the right-hand side of this is actually taken from St. Boniface General Hospital, and it shows the data, and I believe this data was for 2008, I believe, but it shows you the percentage of hospitalized patients that were put on isolation precautions, and you can see that C. diff, which is shown in red, about 48% of all the reasons for why patients get put on isolation precautions is because they have C. diff-associated disease. Now, the other big offender is MRSA, which is shown on the left side of that pie, and it represents about 35% of all the patients that are put on isolation precautions. It's because of MRSA. But I would like to point out there's a big difference between those two parts of the pie. MRSA is patients ill or who are carriers of MRSA. And in fact, I would hazard to say that the vast majority of what you're seeing there is probably due to people who are carrying MRSA, and those individuals will get put on isolation precautions as well. The C. difficile part of the pie is people who are ill with C. diff infection. And so you can see as an infectious etiology, C. diff occupies a huge portion of the reasons of why patients get put on isolation precautions. So again, the nosocomial and community aspect of C. diff is something we're really starting to recognize, that in healthcare facilities where we put patients on isolation, C. diff is a major player in that ballpark, and that there are 30% of the cases that may acquire and have their onset in community, they often end up getting hospitalized if they're really quite ill, and again, become put on isolation precautions in the healthcare facilities. Now, if we move on to the next slide, this slide represents C. difficile spores and what we're starting to understand about where it's coming from and how we're exposed in the community. We've done studies in Manitoba, and there's a number of other ones that have been done throughout the world, actually, and there's more and more evidence showing that C. diff spores are actually found in meat products, vegetable products, and although the level of spores per gram of material, whether it's meat or vegetable, might be low, the reality is that those spores are present. They may have arisen from the animals themselves as being a reservoir, because there's many animals that carry C. diff in their GI tract, and there are also a large number of animals that get sick with C. diff diarrhea. Scours or diarrhea in piglets is a huge problem, and one of the big offenders is C. difficile. Horses can get sick with it. There's a number of mammals that certainly do get ill with it. And of course, if there's natural fertilization of vegetable products, it might be manure that's being used that has C. difficile spores in it that's being spread on the lettuce, which we then subsequently ingest. Now, what is really freaky, and I'm a microbiologist, so forgive me, I get excited about these things, but it's really freaky to realize that the meats and vegetables, even if you cook them, they do not kill the C. difficile spores. And we're going to talk a bit about the heat and the effect it has on spores. But for every other enteric pathogen, whether it's a virus or a bacteria, if you properly cook your products, your food products, you will never get infected from those organisms. And that's not the case with C. diff. You can cook the heck out of that hamburger, and if it's got a C. diff spore in it, when you eat it, it still has the potential to colonize and cause disease in you because the thermal conditions for cooking are inadequate to kill C. diff spores. Now, if we go on to the next slide, this is just a summary to kind of, pull together everything I've talked about up to this point. C. diff is a really unique nosocomial model. On the left side of the slide, we have the community exposure, and there's more and more evidence to suggest that the food chain is a source for us to be exposed to that first hit. In other words, we are probably all, whether we eat meat or vegetables, we are probably ingesting C. diff spores at low levels, off and on all the time, and that will probably lead to transient low levels of spores in the gut in any individual over time. On the right-hand side of the slide is really the nosocomial picture. And patients can get sick. They may acquire it and develop disease in the community, but ultimately they may have to be hospitalized because of it. Or they may come in perfectly well and acquire their C. diff spores within the healthcare environment. And when they get the second hit of antibiotics or something to upset the bowel flora, they then will develop diarrhea and illness. Now, the transmission, and I'm going to now start focusing on the nosocomial or the hospital side of things. A nosocomial transmission, it's well known that the hands of caregivers are important in that, and the other component is the environment as a reservoir. So whether that's the toilets, the commodes, bedpans, or the environment. Now, one of the things that I had mentioned to you previously was the tiny size of these spores. And if you go to the next slide, that spore characteristics really do have an impact in terms of how they are transmitted and some of the issues around recognizing what we need to do to try and break the chain of infection. So the very first bullet I've got here is alcohol hand hygiene. We have spent years educating healthcare facilities and the general public about how valuable it is to do good hand hygiene, and that because people often don't take adequate time to do the proper washing with soap and water, the use of the alcohol hand hygiene agents has become a really excellent alternative that should facilitate reducing spread by caregivers' hands. Now, as I've mentioned previously, alcohol does little to kill C. diff spores. And in fact, in the research lab, when we make spore preps, we store them in alcohol for many years, and there's no problem with viability of those spores. So the CDC recommendations are that really in healthcare facilities, soap and water should be used for washing of hands because that will physically help remove those spores from the hands. I would be a strong advocate, or I am a strong advocate, that we don't want to undo all the education we've done on how valuable alcohol hand hygiene is. And I want to remind people that the alcohol does kill the vegetative form, even though it doesn't kill the spore form. So I still think that alcohol hand hygiene is important, and we definitely do not want to undo the education we've done up to this point on the value of it. I think what we need to do is for those patients who have C. diff-associated disease, we need to remind people that in addition to alcohol hand hygiene, when you remove your gloves, when you're doing hand hygiene, you really should include soap and water hand hygiene as well. But that doesn't mean that we ban alcohol hand hygiene agents from the rooms of these patients because it's still playing a big role in killing vegetative forms. Now, the second bullet on this slide is regarding heat treatment. And I've mentioned already thermal decontamination at 80 degrees centigrade for 1 minute, and the cooking temperatures that we use at home or commercially will not kill these spores. So remember that even though you're cooking things, that is not going to eradicate them. And I'm going to touch on this a little bit later when we talk about thermal decontamination for bedpans. The third bullet here is disinfectant treatment, and often it needs substantial contact time, and the ability to kill C. diff spores is very formulation and concentration dependent. And we're going to touch on that when I touch on some of the research data from our attempts to look at, is there a way to kill C. diff spores or to look at cleaning and disinfecting the environment in healthcare that is independent of using agents like bleach, because they're quite difficult to work with. So those are some very unique spore characteristics. Now, if we look at what are the spore issues in healthcare, which is on the next slide, and one of the big issues is that they are a reservoir for nosocomial spread. So if you have spores in the healthcare environment, the potential is there that that provides a reservoir and that people coming in may get their spore hit from the actual environment in which they are admitted to. And there's a couple of areas here that I want to touch on and share some data with you regarding. The first of these is bedpan reprocessing and ward bedpan washer disinfectors that use thermal cycle or thermal component in their cycle. There are some things you need to be aware of as you're making your decisions about whether you're going to have these, and also if you have them, what do you need the manufacturer to be able to show to you to feel confident that you're not going to have some residual C. difficile spores post-processing. And then the second bullet is environmental cleaning and looking at issues in particular around the bathrooms and the facilities in patients that actually have disease. And I want to make a plug right here. Personally, I believe the highest time of risk for anybody in healthcare that has C. diff diarrhea, the highest time of risk of them spreading it to other people, is just prior to when the diagnosis is made, because that's when they're going to have clinically significant diarrhea. They will not be on isolation precautions yet because they haven't been diagnosed with the infection, and they certainly have the potential to spread their sporulating organisms to their roommates and certainly contaminate the environment with them. So my goal in looking at the environmental issues is, ideally, I think we should have agents that are used for routine housekeeping, and that would reduce the risk of the environment being a reservoir for any patients with diarrhea. And minimally then, if that's not possible, then minimally ensuring that those patients who, once they are diagnosed, at least we are dealing with the environment in a way that is effective. And then the final bullet here is really the outbreaks. We know there's been lots of studies published to suggest that bleach is one of the things that should be used when there's outbreaks going on. But any of you who've had to use this in your healthcare facility know that it is a workplace hazard and that it is very corrosive in many instances. And all of us are trying to find alternatives to this. And I want to share some data on a recent publication and study that we did. So moving on to the next slide, this is the healthcare bedpan sprayer issue, and some of you may have seen this slide before, but I'd like to include it because it really does emphasize. At the facility that I work at, they used to have these sprayer units, and you can see in the picture on the left-hand side a lovely toilet in a healthcare facility and one of those notorious bedpan sprayers. And what we've done is magged up the end of the bedpan sprayer on the right bottom picture. And yes, that little brown thing you see on the end, that is not rust. That is what you think it is. It's a gob of poop. And this is a really gross example of how fecal material can certainly remain on these bedpan sprayers. And obviously there's a lot of guidance documents recommending that these should not be used in healthcare facilities if at all possible, and alternative means of trying to clean out or dump the bedpans should be used. And one of the studies that's been done that's quite interesting is this concept of, it doesn't take much rocket science to recognize you're going to get aerosolization of fecal material when you use a high-pressure water source and you spray out the contents of a bedpan into the toilet. You're definitely going to be aerosolizing it. You're putting the healthcare worker who's doing that at risk, and you're certainly shedding it into the environment or spreading it so that it can deposit at various other places in the toilet facility. But recent studies have actually indicated that because the spores are so tiny that they can actually remain airborne for quite a long period of time. And there is evidence to suggest that it's not just the droplets that are shedding into the environment, it's the fact that they can actually spread in some ways similar to airborne a spreading of other microorganisms that we do know are airborne spread. So it's not really recognized as an airborne pathogen, but certainly there's some data to suggest that the ability of it to reach various far geographic locations can only be explained if it was carried there by maybe airborne mechanisms. So again, we want to reduce aerosolization and we want to reduce the risk of spores getting in and forming a reservoir. If you go to the next slide, you will see this is a front-end picture showing a bedpan that's been loaded into a bedpan washer disinfector. And one of the alternatives to those bedpan sprayers was the idea that on the ward there would be a unit that would be able to dump the waste from a bedpan and urinal and then be able to properly clean it and decontaminate it so it was safe to use on another patient. So there are various manufacturers. The intent is that they're installed right on the ward. They flush away. They're like a flusher. They flush the toilet paper, the fecal, and the urine waste, and then they clean reusable bedpans and use thermal disinfection as a mechanism of theoretically making them safe to handle. And the idea is that once that bedpan or urinal has been processed through the ward bedpan washer, it's then safe to use on the next patient. Now, the ISO or the ISO guidelines for units like this set what's called an A sub not zero, and that's just a fancy term for the thermal conditions. They set them to say that these types of units should have minimally 80 degrees centigrade for 1 minute, or an A sub not zero that equals 60. And what we have found through a number of studies is that that was probably there was lack of insight when that was set because it is suboptimal and it does not adequately address C. diff spores. And if we look at the next slide, I'm just going to very quickly take you through a simulated use testing study that we did. And we actually did this for a totally different reason, but what we found out was totally unexpected, that if we take fecal material, and you can see in the pictures, that's what we've done with those blue-looking plastic bedpans, we took fecal material, we steam sterilized it and proved that there was no organisms in it, and then we spiked it with C. difficile spores, and the inoculated area that you can see on those bedpans, we did one inside the bedpan and one on the outside of it, and that circle contains 4 logs of C. diff spores in the presence of otherwise sterile fecal debris. And why we did this was that's the material that normally is in this bedpan, and we wanted to see whether the washer disinfector could actually, number one, clean it properly, and number two, be sure that there was no residual spores there. And at the bottom of the slide, you'll see we used Rodac plates with culture media in them, and we would, after they came out of the bedpan washer, we would press the auger on top of that circular area that was inoculated and then incubate it to see if there was any surviving spores. Now, on the right-hand side of this picture is a sealed vial with sterile fecal material in it, and we did this part of the testing to determine, with no wash-off, because the vial is sealed, nothing gets cleaned out of it, we wanted to see whether the thermal conditions were adequate to kill spores just from the temperature alone. And so our testing included a suspension in a sealed vial that was put through the cycle, and we assessed it afterwards and quantitated the viable C. diff spores that survived the thermal treatment. Now, if you go to the next slide, this slide, in a way, says it all. It assesses the thermal killing of bacteria. The graph shown under A, which is gram-positive vegetative organisms, this is Enterococcus faecium, and you can see at time zero, the bar represents and shows you that we have 8 logs per mil. If we expose it to even 1 minute of temperature at, in this case, it's 90 degrees centigrade, but we tested 80, 85, 90, and 95, and the same things happened in all of them, even 1 minute of exposure of E. faecium to that temperature will actually kill every one of those 8 logs of E. faecium. The same thing for gram-negative vegetative organisms. In this case, we were testing Acinetobacter baumannii, and the same thing. Within 1 minute, 8 logs, 8.5 logs get killed, no problem. C. diff spores, on the other hand, is a totally different ballpark. And you can see that even after 5 minutes of exposure, you barely have about one log drop in the spore level. And we did publish this study, and essentially what it says is the thermal conditions in the ward bedpan washer disinfectors are inadequate on their own to eradicate reliably C. diff spores. So what was happening is you would reprocess a bedpan that had been used by a patient that had C. diff disease, thinking it was safe then to give it to another patient, when in actuality there's a very high likelihood that it would have had surviving C. difficile spores on it, even though it looked clean, because the fecal material was physically washed off, but the C. diff spores survived the temperature and survived the washing. Now, if you go to the next slide, what we found was that it was very dependent on the formulation of the detergent that was used by the particular ward bedpan washer disinfector. So we know the thermal conditions are not going to be adequate, and the picture on the left is essentially showing you that. The white bar represents the CPD, or the Central Processing Department. When we put the bedpans through their washer disinfectors, positive control, which means it didn't go through the washer disinfector, shows you that we have, average, there's at least 100 CFU in that inoculated site on the bedpan. And if we take bedpans without inoculating them and we touch the auger to it, that's what the negative control is, and it shows you there's no detectable spores normally. The plastic bedpans, after they come out of the CPD washer disinfector, the white bar is essentially zero. All the spores were eradicated, and that means they were either washed off or killed by the thermal conditions, but the ward washer disinfector did not do that. And the same thing occurred for what is shown as SS-BP, that means stainless steel bedpans, and the urinals as well. Now, that was how we got into this problem, and what we found as we worked, and we had the same findings for many different types of ward bedpan washer disinfectors. They were being sold, and sites were told they either did not need detergent, or there was a routine detergent you could use if you so desired. We did testing in both scenarios, and the same thing was shown, that even with the routine detergent, you didn't get complete eradication of the C. diff spores. However, we worked with some of the manufacturers, and there certainly have been alkaline detergents developed that, when used with the routine bedpan cycle and the routine thermal conditions, were effective and eradicated the spores using a combination of good cleaning because of the alkaline detergent, good wash-off, and the combination of the alkaline detergent with the thermal conditions was adequate to eradicate C. diff, and you could feel confident that your bedpans could now be given to another patient and you didn't have to worry about it. So one of the take-home messages from this, or the take-home message, is if you do have ward bedpan washer disinfectors, ensure the cycle is validated for C. diff. Ask the manufacturer to show you the data that they have a combination of detergent and thermal conditions that will eradicate C. diff spores. That's very important. Now, if we go to the next slide, healthcare environmental cleaning issues. I cannot overemphasize the role of housekeeping. They're the front line in the battle of the bugs, and many sites, including ours, have for years indicated and insisted that we need audit tools that are better than the visually clean audit tool that many of the sites have been using since time immemorial. And the other issue is there an alternative to bleach for C. difficile eradication? Because that is what's recommended in many of the guidelines if you have an ongoing outbreak of C. diff and it's still spreading and you need to do something drastic, whip out the bleach. And that has been shown to in combination with education and a number of other things, help break those outbreaks. So if we go on to the next slide, I'm going to try and summarize what's a very complex topic in a very short period of time. Ourselves and many others have developed and I think validated the fact that the UV marker is a very good tool to use. It's inexpensive, easy to do, and it allows you a better audit tool than just visual inspection. And what it's measuring is simply that the surface was wiped. In other words, housekeeping actually did wipe that surface, and that's all it's measuring. It's not telling you anything about microbial loads or anything like that, but it does show you that that surface was wiped. Now, what is scary is, like everything else in life, when you talk to housekeeping staff, they feel they're doing a good job, and the visual inspection audits would suggest they were doing a good job. But in reality, when you use something like a UV marker and say, okay, our protocol says the toilet underside of the lid should be cleaned, and you find that you've only got very poor compliance, that obviously means that the tools used weren't adequate and housekeeping didn't know, but in actuality, they weren't doing a good job. Now, we undertook a study to assess whether sustained feedback to the housekeeping staff could improve their compliance. And the graph I'm showing you in this slide, that target of 90% compliance was selected by the housekeeping staff themselves. It wasn't the research group that elected to target that. The housekeeping staff targeted it. And the blue bar, or the bar on the far left at week zero, shows you, and we had been doing this for 6 weeks prior to when this study started, and pretty much without any feedback, the number of surfaces that were actually properly being wiped, the compliance was only about 55%. And that's really tough, and it's scary, because what it means is they're our front line in reducing the reservoir of organisms in the environment, and if only 55% of the sites are being properly wiped, you know, obviously we're not getting the environmental cleaning that is really needed. Now, the remainder of what's shown on this graph is 24 weeks, where what we did was we provided feedback, and every week represents about 150 samples, and that went on for 24 weeks. And what we found was that with sustained feedback, you can get sustained compliance above the 90% level. And there's a few nuances in here that I'm not going to take the time to go into. What this proved to us was that when you're trying to do an intervention with a new agent as a housekeeping agent and you're hoping it has C. diff activity, you know, obviously, unless you know that surface has been wiped with that agent, you can't analyze any of the culture data you then subsequently take, because if the agent wasn't applied, it doesn't matter if it's bleach or any other agent, it's not going to have had any effect on the organisms because it wasn't applied. So any intervention that you do, you need to take that into consideration. And if we move on to the next slide, what we did was at the time when our compliance was around 55%, that's when we were doing our intervention study. We hadn't implemented the UV audit as the routine audit in housekeeping, but what we decided to do was we would use it in our intervention study, and we would analyze the data only if we knew the surface had actually been wiped, because then we knew that whatever agent we were testing had actually been applied to the surface. So if you go to the next slide, this one slide is summarizing the entire study, and the reference is given there if you would like to look at it, and it's free on Biomed Central's website. We tested many different housekeeping and cleaning agents, and we ended up settling on an accelerated hydrogen peroxide, and the name I'm giving because that is the name of what we used in the evaluation. And we chose this agent simply because it was one of the few that we tested in preliminary studies that showed some C. diff sporicidal capacity in a very short period of time. Many of the agents that are out there will kill C. diff spores, but they require like an hour, 20 minutes, 30 minutes of contact time. And in reality, that isn't the contact time that cleaning agents have when they're applied to a surface. So to try to summarize this data, there were three different arms. It took us well over 2 years to get this prospective clinical study completed. And what we did was, for each of these arms, arm one, we had 50 patients who were enrolled. There was 133 samples that we could analyze because we also had the UV marker data to show that those sites had been wiped and that data could be included. From all the arms of the study, we excluded any test samples of C. diff survival if we had UV data that showed that the surface hadn't been cleaned with the agent, regardless of which agent was used. So arm one, these are patients that had C. diff diarrhea. They were supposed to be getting twice daily cleaning, and they were being used, or the rooms were being cleaned, or the toilet facilities with Oxivir TB only. That was the only agent available for cleaning, and it was monitored to make sure that that was the only agent that was used. Arm 2 had 68 patients enrolled, 254 samples. This arm were patients that had C. diff, getting twice daily cleaning, using the existing agent, which was per diem, which does not claim to have any C. difficile sporicidal ability and doesn't. And arm 3 were patients with diarrhea not due to C. diff. They were not in isolation. They had once daily cleaning with the same housekeeping agent, the per diem. And what you can see from the graph, and there is a significant reduction between arm 2 and arm 1, you can see that it's really quite shocking, actually, that patients with C. diff, you know, when per diem was used, and despite they were supposed to be getting twice daily cleaning, it's pretty apparent that even when the agent was applied, fully 45% of those patients continue to have C. diff in their toilet facility. Now, in arm 1, where the only difference was that Oxivir was used instead of per diem, you can see that there was a drop down to about 17% detection of C. diff in the toilets. And if you look at arm 3, which is patients with diarrhea, this is kind of like the background level of C. diff. There's about 10% as the background level of C. diff in the patient rooms. Now, you can see that the Oxivir didn't drop it all the way down to 10%, but it significantly reduced what was a very large reservoir. 45% of the toilet facilities of the patients in those rooms, obviously any other patient using that toilet facility, and especially if they're shared rooms, the significant transmission potential is definitely there. So we published this, and basically it indicates scientifically that there is an alternative to bleach that can be used that will significantly reduce the spore level in the environment. Now, obviously, ideally, it'd be nice to use this at all times, because then our background level, whether you have C. diff disease or not, should be between about 16 to 10%, and that would be much lower than the 45% that would be the case if it's not used. Now, if we go on to the next slide, I'd like in the last couple of minutes just to summarize the key spore issues. So one of them is that C. difficile-associated disease has a very unique pathogenicity and infection chain. Spores are found in the food chain, and about 30% of the onset of this disease occurs in the community. Spores in the healthcare environment do form a reservoir, and the potential for transmission is definitely there. In terms of spore characteristics, it is resistant to thermal killing, alcohol, cleaning agents, and disinfectants, and it's a beggar to try to get out of the environment once it's in. And I think we can never completely eradicate spores from the environment, but what we can do is get the level down to as low as is possible, and I think our study contributes to the fact that there are some other agents beyond bleach that can be used to achieve that goal. So in terms of healthcare spore issues, the ward bedpan washers, make sure you ensure there's a validated cycle that accommodates eradication of C. diff, and then they're good because they reduce the aerosolization of any fecal material because of the way they work. Hand hygiene, ensure soap and water are used for patients on isolation due to C. diff, and that should be not uneducating the alcohol hand hygiene picture. And for housekeeping, you need to make sure you have good audit tools to ensure cleaning compliance, because that's our frontline defense. And our intervention study was able to show that there are some bleach alternatives that are available. So if we go to the next and the last slide, I'd like to leave you with the thought that what you can't see can hurt you. C. difficile is definitely a sinister spore saga, and I hope that what I've been able to achieve today is some tidbits of insight into things that are important to consider when you're looking at this in your facility, and the things that you can do to try to reduce C. diff as a reservoir, if you will, within healthcare. Thanks so much, and hopefully everyone's still awake, and there were at least some insights that were provided by today's session. Thank you.
Dr. Alpha, thank you very much. Always interesting and fascinating, actually, and you are the only member of our faculty who could get away with gob of poop. Thank you for what is always a great teleclass. And I should mention as well that the teleclass education program does not promote or endorse any company or product. And any company names or product names that are mentioned should not be taken as an endorsement. Having said that, I will also mention that there is a teleclass coming up in 2011 that's specifically on bedpan management in a modern age, and I think that's going to be fascinating. I would like to thank 3M for their sponsorship of today's teleclass. They've been very good to us in the past, and I am very grateful to all of them. Again, thank you for joining us. Michelle, thank you again for a really interesting presentation, a classic Michelle Alpha teleclass lecture. Thank you very, very much.
You're more than welcome.
Until we talk again, everyone, goodbye.